is submitted. Our next case for argument is Free the Nipple versus City of Fort Collins. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew Rengel on behalf of the City of Fort Collins. May it please the Court. In granting the plaintiff's motion for preliminary injunction, the District Court admittedly went out on a lonely limb. I would ask this Court to decline the plaintiff's invitation to join the District Court on its lonely limb.
Well, the lonely limb reference, what do we really know what he was talking about there? I mean, you're saying that he was making a legal ruling that he is alone in making. That's your assumption, right?
Well, in the context of the paragraph, Your Honor, he cites then the cases that go the other way.
Okay.
And basically says that I'm not following those cases. So I think in context, that makes sense. And there are at least 19 cases that have gone the other way here, four circuit cases, a variety of federal district court cases, and a variety of state court cases. And I think...
Do these cases turn on evidence presented?
No. Most of them are dismissals, Your Honor. And they go to the legitimacy of the reason, and they go to the legal determination about whether this is invidious discrimination. And I think that the focus of the district court's opinion and where the district court, with respect, got it wrong was neglecting to focus on the part of the 14th Amendment analysis that requires invidious discrimination. What the district court did was suggest that a perpetuation of a sex stereotype in and of itself creates a 14th Amendment constitutional violation. That's not the law, Your Honors. The Supreme Court has been very clear over the years that what is the law is invidious discrimination. It is, I looked this morning, Your Honors, and in neither the district court's order on the motion to dismiss, refusing to dismiss the 14th Amendment equal protection claim, or in the order on preliminary injunction, does the district court use or analyze whether this is invidious discrimination? That is a fundamental requirement of the 14th Amendment. It is not enough to say that this discriminates in terms of differentiates between men and women.
Well,
it clearly does.
The ordinance applies only to women, right?
I don't agree with the interpretation of the district court, and here's why, Your Honor. What the ordinance does is says the genitalia and private parts of both men and women need to be covered from public view. Fundamentally, the difference is women have breasts that are considered private parts. Men don't have breasts that are considered private parts, and therefore it treats them the same. It just differentiates between what is within the quantum of the coverage that's required. So it really isn't a differentiation, and it's certainly not a differentiation that's
insidious. So when it
says
no female who and then lists, that's not differentiating between the sexes?
It differentiates, but it doesn't do it on an invidious basis.
Okay.
That's the point. And it has to be invidious before it is discriminatory, rising to the level of discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause.
In United States versus Virginia, there's this sentence. Parties who seek to defend gender-based government action must demonstrate, quote, exceedingly persuasive justification, unquote, for that action. You're shrinking that, aren't you? This is a very broad statement.
Your Honor, the problem with taking that statement, I agree that that statement is in the VMLA case. There's no question about it. But you only get to that statement when there is invidious discrimination.
Where does that say? I don't see that.
Well, all of the decisions from the United States Supreme Court universally say invidious discrimination. And that's
that.
The fundamental requirement. And where it talks about it in the VMI decision is the classification cannot be used to create or perpetuate legal, social, and economic inferiority of women. The gravamen of VMI and the notion of it is the differentiation of the societal construct of men as breadwinners, women as homemakers.
That's one.
And that's one. But what the district court did here, Your Honor, is suggest that if there's any societal stereotype, if there's a social stereotype that's included in the law, that in and of itself is discriminatory, and that's not what VMI says, and that's not what the 14th Amendment says.
Right.
And so fundamentally, that's the problem.
This is exceedingly persuasive justification. You're saying in this case, the standard should be what?
Okay. I'm saying two things, Your Honor. If you get to a classification that differentiates against women on a suspect basis, that's when you get to intermediate scrutiny and you do the exceedingly persuasive classification.
So what is it here? Just whatever the government wants?
No, Your Honor. What is it here is you have to analyze whether this is invidious discrimination.
And if it's not.
The 14th Amendment has an intent requirement. There is no question about that. Every 14th Amendment case talks about discriminatory intent. And if there is no discriminatory intent, you don't need to get to the second part of the analysis is, what is the justification for the discriminatory
intent?
Well,
then why do you give us justifications? You tell us maintaining public order, watch out for children, public safety, quiet enjoyment, private property, impact on businesses.
We are arguing it on both grounds, Your Honor, as we are able to do. And the fact that the district court didn't dismiss it and held a preliminary injunction hearing required us to present evidence on the justifications because that was part of what the factual grist for the district court's analysis on preliminary injunction.
Well, if we disagree with you on the invidious discrimination mark, that it has to meet that in every instance to be operable gender discrimination, here's my question. If this indeed applies, must demonstrate an exceedingly persuasive justification for that action, and then I've just read you what the justifications are, my understanding and from the briefs and as well as Judge Jackson's order is that there are a number of local governments nearby that do not require, don't have the same requirement as Fort Collins does, and none of those, I haven't read any news reports of the sort of calamity that is being described with these five detrimental results that are asserted. How have you made your case that indeed you have, if intermediate scrutiny does apply, that you have made the case that these are substantially related to an important government objective?
Okay. Well, first, Your Honor, I would point to the decisions that have preceded this, including the Seventh Circuit's decision and the City of Chicago case that came out approximately 6 weeks ago. Those cases universally hold that the public sensibility, the public safety, and the context of making this something that's not public is a legitimate government interest. We described the basis for it at the preliminary injunction hearing, and specifically the testimony from the deputy city manager, the assistant police chief, and the aquatic supervisor described it in terms of what is the issue in terms of public order and public safety, and specifically the context at a public swimming pool. And I understand Judge Jackson's point to suggest that the world is not falling apart in Denver or Boulder when this may exist in Denver or Boulder. And it goes and it dovetails with Judge Jackson's other point, which is most people have the common sense and decency not to do this in public and choose whether they have the right to do it or not, not to do it in public. Fundamentally, Your Honor, that's the problem with proof here. It's the equivalent of us having to prove a negative. Until and unless this is something that happens on a regular basis at a place like a swimming pool, there is an element of us predicting what the behavior is of people in context based on the evidence that we have. The example of the swimming pool and Ms. Greer's testimony, I think, is important in this context, Your Honor. She talked about the problems that have happened in the bathroom related to children seeing adults in a state of undress and adults not wanting to be seen by children in a state of undress and how people complain about that and how that's an issue with respect to the context of a public swimming pool. It is not an unreasonable assumption on her part to suggest that if you include a topless female at outside in front of the pool or in the pool, that that has the potential to have
If you're speaking about concern for children seeing breasts, what do we do about the breastfeeding permission that's given?
Your Honor, the reason that that is in existence there is there's a state law in Colorado that says you can't restrict breastfeeding in any public place. Fort Collins doesn't have a choice to have an exception for that.
So you would regulate it if you could.
I don't know whether the city would regulate it or not, but I don't think the fact that they included an exception can be used against them because it's a matter of Colorado law.
It seems to be counterintuitive to say children are shocked at one point but not at the other when we're talking about the same thing.
I don't think we're really talking about the same thing.
A breast is a breast, is it not?
A breast is a breast. A female breast is a female breast, Your Honor. Yeah. There's no question about that, except the context of it, as this court understands intuitively, when a mother is breastfeeding, there may be an exposure of the breast sort of before and after the breastfeeding or when the baby is being burped or something like that. That's altogether different than what this allows of a woman who's topless to, if she wants to parade in front of the elementary school as the kids are coming out of the elementary school on a daily basis. That's the fundamental difference here. And what the city legitimately, in my view, is concerned about is the potential of self-help for the people in the city who don't like this to occur. And that's the fundamental issue with respect to public order.
When you say self-help, you're saying if this is what the majority wants, that's what they should get?
No, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is it's a legitimate interest for the city to not want, in a context like the New West Fest, to have someone who is topless, who causes a spectacle, who causes people to be angry at that person, who potentially causes people to do things to suggest that that person may not be.
So you're saying that we need this ordinance to protect people who would go topless from being attacked?
I think that there is that possibility of societal disruption when
that
this exists.
That sounds like the heckler's veto.
I understand the notion of the heckler's veto, and I think that that's an important thing to think about, Your Honor, because clearly this is not a First Amendment case. And many of the cases that are cited by counsel for the plaintiffs in this instance are First Amendment. And the First Amendment is not before this court. That was dismissed by Judge Jackson.
But it is the same principle that you can't do this because somebody might attack you for doing it. That's not a...
Your Honor, I understand the context, and but the point was of the testimony of the deputy city manager and the assistant chief of police had to do with you have a crowd, you have a lot of people milling about, you have families, you have a context in which adding this to that context has the potential for disruption. Judge Jackson is right. I don't have evidence, and we didn't present it at the hearing that said, There was on such and such a date this particular woman who went out there and was topless, and this is how the stuff hit the fan in that context. But given the social moray and the social opprobrium that exists in this context, it's not surprising that that evidence doesn't exist. And it doesn't seem right to me to inflate one little sliver of what these women cannot do in the city of Fort Collins to the totality of everything that they can do in the city of Fort Collins. This is not about economic opportunity. This is not about the social status of women. This isn't about the legal status of women. The two plaintiffs in this case, the only restriction that exists is a ban on female toplessness. That's it. And as the 19 other courts that have addressed this issue, including four of your sister circuits, have found, it's a relatively straightforward case, and we ask that the district court be reversed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honor. Andy McNulty on behalf of the plaintiff's appellees in this case. Judge Briscoe, you were correct earlier when you said that this ordinance discriminates on its face. And Judge Phillips, you were correct earlier when you said that there's no SCOTUS case that talks about invidious discrimination when there's a ordinance that discriminates on its face. The invidious discrimination standard comes from cases where it's facially neutral, and where there's a disparity in the treatment of women on a facially neutral statute. They didn't bring up this invidious discrimination concept at the district court level. They talked about it briefly in their briefing, but didn't really get into it. I think that the court should follow the standard in VMI, which says that the burden of justification is demanding and it rests entirely on the state. Now, the state hasn't met their burden in this case. Based on the record below, it was clear that this ordinance was enacted to criminalize women and was doing so on the basis of sex stereotypes. There was testimony at the preliminary injunction hearing from an expert, the only expert at the hearing, who stated that this law and these sorts of laws are enacted because women's breasts are seen as inherently sexual. And there was also testimony that rebutted every single justification put forth by the defendants. There was testimony.
What do we do with the 19 other courts that were told gone the other way?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think there's ways to distinguish those cases. The first way is the evidentiary record in this case is very different than those cases. In those cases, they were mainly on motions to dismiss. And the courts in those cases didn't have the record that overwhelmingly supports plaintiff's position like they do in this case.
Well, when it's dismissed on a motion to dismiss, that means no matter what evidence you put on, it's not going to make a difference.
So it's
not really accurate to say, well, we had evidence and they didn't, when the other courts apparently are saying, we don't care what your evidence is.
I think that's right, Your Honor, to an extent. I think that on a motion to dismiss, it's based on what's pled in the complaint. And in those cases, I doubt that they were pleading the evidence that we have from our expert in their complaints. Additionally, Your Honor, I think there's another way to distinguish those cases, not just based on the procedural posture. A large majority of them were decided either before United States versus Virginia or before Lawrence versus Texas, which said that just base morality can't override equal protection rights. And the Lawrence decision is important because in this case it seems like defendants are relying solely on the personal predilections of the majority of people in Fort Collins. And I don't even know if the majority of people support this law. It's just based on who came out to the city council hearing. Because certainly there are a large number of people who our clients know who support it, who don't support the law. But Lawrence said that base morality, ideas of what's appropriate, decency, these things can't override important 14th Amendment rights. And so...
Well, that had to do with sexual behavior. There was an intimacy issue in Lawrence, was there not? Wasn't that very important in the Supreme Court's decision in Lawrence?
That was part of it, Your Honor, certainly. But it was also an equal protection challenge. And they talked about the equal protection clause in making their decision. Justice Kennedy, he definitely did not say that this is only decided on grounds of a fundamental right. And he specifically talked about demonizing a certain segment of society just because of the popular because of popular prejudice. And I think that's something that might be happening in this case as well. And importantly, Your Honors, I know that the Togami case just came out versus City of Chicago. That's the one case that has happened post-Lawrence and post-BMI. Now, it's important that the court looks at the majority decision in that case and looks at what their reasoning was for upholding the ordinance. And it specifically cited societal disapproval of nudity as the reason why that law was justified. Now, post-Lawrence, I don't think that that flies anymore. The Supreme Court was pretty clear that societal disapproval can't be the basis for a law when it implicates, you know, fundamental rights under the Constitution, and specifically equal protection rights. And in this case, we have evidence that female toplessness isn't nudity in the same way that nudity, in terms of genital nudity. Our expert, Dr. Roberts, testified that nudity for that male breasts are substantially similar to female breasts, that they have no inherent sexuality other than what's projected on them by society. And so for purposes of this case, I don't think that it's in a similar procedural posture as a Togami case.
On invidious discrimination, you responded to that, arguing they really didn't press that much in district court. If we address that issue, how do you respond to that? Do you think that there's not a requirement of invidious discrimination, or do you say that there is invidious discrimination here?
I think both, Your Honor. I'd say both. So first, there's if you look at Virginia, if you look at Wynn, if you look at Hibbs, if you look at all of these cases, none of them talk about invidious discrimination. There was also testimony at the hearing about invidious discrimination. Our clients felt like they were denigrated by this ordinance. Our expert testified that laws like this demonize women and have substantial negative effects on them. There's also evidence from Ray Martinez, who's one of the city councilors, and his testimony at the hearing, at the city council meeting, that said that women's breasts are equivalent to pornography. If you look at the appendix, volume 2, pages 142 to 147, that's where his comments are. And there are a number of comments from city members of the city who talk about women's breasts being pornographic, how women standing topless would just harm family friendliness and morality. And that's on volume 2, page 67 to 136 of the appendix. So I think there's ample evidence in the record of invidious discrimination in this case.
Let me ask you about something from Virginia. It may not have used the term invidious discrimination, but what it says, I think this is where the court is encapsulating its principle here. It says, the law must not rely on overbroad generalizations about the different talents, capacities, or preferences of males and females. Where do you see this ordinance fitting that requirement?
I think, Your Honor, it perfectly fits preferences. Now, defendants would think that women don't prefer to stand topless in public, and maybe some women don't, but some women would. And so I think that treating women differently just because we think that women have a preference of not standing topless in public seems problematic under the Equal Protection Clause.
I guess I don't follow that. They're not saying we're doing this because women don't want to do it. We're forbidding this because women don't want to do it. They're saying whether they want to do it or not, it should be prohibited.
Right.
So where is there an assumption about female preferences there?
I think there's an assumption about female preferences in that allowing women to be topless would be against the norm. And so it's violating norms, and that's what the problem is with defendants. They think that female toplessness is not normal and shouldn't be allowed because it's not normal.
But I ask you to fit your argument mm-hmm. to this statement in Virginia about the sort of overbroad, it's concerned about overbroad generalizations
mm-hmm.
and treating women differently from men because, women belong in the home, or women aren't very good at science or something like mm-hmm. that, which obviously is invidious also. But what they talk about was not overbroad generalizations about everything. It talks about overbroad generalizations about the different talents, capacities or preferences of males and females. And the one thing you mentioned is preferences. I'm not sure I understand your argument there. Maybe after I think about it more, it'll be more convincing to me. But how do you is there anything else you can say about fitting that language in Virginia?
Certainly, Your Honor, I can. I can try and clarify. I probably wasn't as clear as I should have been earlier. This is about women's, you know, you said that, you know, women should be in the home or women don't have the talents and capacities to do this. Well, this says that women's breasts are inherently sexual and women should dress in a certain way because their breasts are inherently sexual. And so I think that in that sense, that's where this fits the Virginia framework.
Which term does it fit? Is that an overbroad generalization about their talents, their capacities?
Certainly about their preferences, Your Honor. I think it fits within the preferences silo of that.
So it's, I'm sorry, just try me one more time. Explain.
Certainly. Your Honor, defendants believe that women's breasts are inherently sexual. And they believe so based on nothing other than their personal prejudice. There's no evidence in this record that says that otherwise that, you know, women's breasts are actually inherently sexual. And so they are saying that because women's breasts are inherently sexual and because it's what we think should be their preference, that they can't stand topless at public places.
To say this should be their preference is the same as a overbroad generalization about their preferences?
Correct.
So the problem here is that the city is assuming women prefer not to go topless in public, and that's an overbroad generalization.
That's right, Your Honor. That's right. And, you know, defendants brought up the economic opportunity argument saying that, you know, the only cases that are out there say that, you know, discrimination that hinders women's economic opportunity are problematic. Well, first off, I think that this case does hinder our clients' economic opportunity. If they're arrested for violating this ordinance, that certainly has economic consequences. They'd have to pay a fine or they'd go to jail. They'd have to hire an attorney. They'd have to tell future employers potentially that they've been arrested. But also there are Supreme Court cases that don't talk about anything having to do with economic opportunity. For example, Craig versus Boren, how does being able to buy near beer relate to economic opportunity? Or this court's case in Lamb versus Brown, which talks about how the disparity in juvenile sentencing between men and women and how that's unconstitutional. It's a similar situation to this one. There's a criminal statute, and it's inhibiting women's freedom to do certain things. So I think that...
Are you concerned about women being unable to be topless dancers? That would be an economic opportunity.
Your Honor, I would be, but they allow topless dancing
okay,
in Fort Collins.
We're good there, then.
We're good there,
so,
yeah.
I guess the city's arguing what's the big deal here, because you're really not hindering anything that should matter in the, I was going to say, the normal life. You're not hindering anything of major consequence. So how is it possibly a constitutional violation?
Mm-hmm. I think certainly throughout history that argument has been thrown out by other folks. How is eating at a lunch counter of any consequence at all? How does that affect your ability to function society? You can just go to another lunch counter.
You're basically saying any regulation that has the audacity to say and limit its application to one sex or the other is inherently a constitutional violation.
I'm not saying it's inherently a constitutional violation. I'm saying that the defendants, the state needs to justify it in some way, shape, or form. And I don't think here, based on this record, the state has justified it in any way.
It may eventually, but not preliminary.
Not preliminarily, at least. It may eventually. I don't foresee that happening personally, but I think it could, I think, I mean, stranger things. In closing, since the beginning of the Equal Protection Clause, there have been cases that have been decided that society thought were problematic at the time. When Frontera was decided, most society thought we would crumble with women going to work. when women were allowed to be on juries, people thought our justice system would fall apart. When gays and lesbians were given the right to have personal relations and marry, people thought that our society would again crumble. And none of this has happened. And we look back on those decisions now, and we see that they were rightly decided at the time. So I ask this court to make the determination that says that any law that says women are prohibited from must be justified. And so appellees ask this court to find that in this case, and on the record in this case, Section 17-142 violates the Equal Protection Clause and do uphold the preliminary injunction. Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted.